listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Despite the fact that the Soviet Union has been gone since December of 1991, it appears that the U.S. Congress, U.S. media, and the U.S. intel agencies, most of which were implicated in the USSR's demise, haven't noticed that they no longer have the so-called evil empire to kick around. Just about every political, social, or economic problem that faces Washington still gets blamed on Moscow. Under the present conditions, it is worth noting exactly what the details were of the dismantling of the USSR. And towards that end, we spoke with Professor Luciana Bone via Skype on Wednesday. So, Luciana, we've been talking for better than a year and change about the history of the Soviet Union. And today, we can talk about the end days. Might be particularly appropriate at this stage in the U.S. history to be looking at the end days of the Soviet Union. In some ways, there's some parallels. And in order to get to that, maybe pick up, as you suggested, in the 80s and 1990 and sort of work our way into what happened in 1991.
Yeah, sure. Well, the year 1991... is key, of course. So many things happened. But in terms of our program, it's also, it's the year in which something called the August coup occurred.
Right.
And that was the last, it's 1991 is the year in which the last attempt to save the Soviet Union was made, and it was made between 19 August and 23 days and 22 August. So we're talking today, 22 August, about around this, what is called a coup in Western discourse or historiography.
Right.
It's called the coup, the Gang of Eight. But in effect, it was a last-ditch attempt to prevent what
right.
was going to happen.
Right, to preserve it. In other words, you had Gorbachev doing, let's say Gorbachev were president of the United States, you have Gorbachev essentially restructuring the U.S. government, pushing control from Washington down to the state governments like the Southerners wanted to do in the Civil War. And the people in the U.S. government standing up and saying, no, here's the Constitution, here's the history of the country, these are the government structures under which you took power, you can't change this, not without consulting the people. And they called their attempt to protect the government against Gorbachev and ultimately Yeltsin and the U.S., they called that a coup.
Yeah.
Right.
And they were the legitimate government, even though...
That's correct.
You know, so how can the legitimate government have a coup? But at any
right.
rate...
Right.
Yeah, it's all screwed up, what we're told. I mean, we need a complete inversion, so...
Right.
We're starting in medias res, in the middle of things here, 1991, August.
Yeah.
But the interesting thing about this coup that you just summarized, the ideas, you know, to act legally, curious thing was that Gorbachev was supposed to sign a treaty called the Union of Sovereign States, that is to change the name,
right?
Of the Soviet Union on the 20th of August, and he was on vacation.
Right. Well, let's back out for a minute because you prepared a really useful outline. Gorbachev slowly works his way, and the forces around him slowly work their way into this position. First, by changing the way that the Soviet Union relates to the other Warsaw Pact members. In other words, you had a bloc of socialist countries that had been standing up to the United States and its NATO allies, quote-unquote, as they put it from time to time, for decades and decades. And suddenly, Gorbachev changes the relationship of the USSR to the Warsaw Pact countries. There are a number of things that have been set in motion by the U.S. and Germany and some others in Czechoslovakia and Hungary and other Eastern European countries that caused severe economic problems, and also there were reactionary forces in Poland in particular that were set in motion. And all of this stuff starts to come to a head in the 80s while Gorbachev decides we're not going to get involved in any of this stuff. And that's kind of the soil that everything follows in.
That's right. The events that led to 1991, the key year for the dissolution of the Soviet Union, the key events is what you mentioned, and it can be summarized in saying that Gorbachev in the 1980s denied military support to the governments of the Soviet Union satellite states. This means, if we think of history, that Hungary in 1956 would have been left undefended from the counter-revolution.
Right.
And in Czechoslovakia in 1968, it would have been left undefended from the what we call the counter-revolutionary element.
Right.
So by withdrawing the military support, and he opened up in the satellite countries what happened, the fall of the Berlin Wall, the East-West German unification, the breakaway of Lithuania, etc. So it's as if, Gorbachev read history and said, huh, if I withdraw the Soviet bases from the Eastern, then the reaction will be emboldened. I had
a
student from Russia in the 1990s, and she was the daughter of somebody who was in charge, a father who was in charge of the military base in Prague, and she said they were absolutely astonished, the Russians in Prague, about just getting the order to leave.
Right.
you know, that sort of thing.
This
so,
is
okay,
in 1968, right? In 1968, when they first got the order to leave, before they came back. That happened.
Yeah. No. I'm talking about
in 1989.
In the 80s. Also, that happened. Just like, in 68, they got the order to leave, but then they had to come back.
Right. So, you know, at that time, back in 1968, for example, also in 1956 in Hungary, also in East Germany, I believe in 1953 or
and in
some
Poland.
Point. Yeah, and in Poland also. When people raised the question about the changes that were being proposed by essentially counter-revolutionaries, the socialists, the communists, said this is actually an attempt at capitalist restoration. And the Trotskyites, all these people, the democratic socialists, the Euro-communists, you know, 20 years later, all said that this was some paranoid delusion, and it was that the Stalinists were afraid of losing their iron grip
power
on the throat or whatever. And then in each and every case in the late 1980s, within days of the declaration that the Communist Party was no longer the leading force in the country, capitalism was restored almost in toto across the countries. I saw it in Czechoslovakia, and I saw it in Poland in 1990.
Yeah. So Gorbachev facilitated this by, denying the muscle in case of counter-revolution. The second point is that the constituent republics of the Soviet Union, not in Asia so much, but in Eastern Europe, started legal moves towards declaring sovereignty, and this was not checked or objected to. For example, Lithuania declared independence on 11 March 1990.
Right.
Behind these movements, as you say, that happened overnight to declare independence and separation from the Union, behind this was, of course, the hand of the Western powers. And as Putin said at the Valdai Forum in November 2017, he says quite clearly, as a former FSB director, I know for sure that there was massive U.S. support for separatism and radicalism. He's speaking about the North Caucasus.
Right.
And he says, do not tell me otherwise, because this I know. And we know from Poland how heavy the hand was of the Vatican and in the movement in Solidarność. But anyway.
Well, you know, so, let me just add, let me add something there, by the way. Go take a look at the nearly 2,000-year history of the Roman Catholic Church, and go back and count on one hand how many popes came from Poland, and then suddenly that pope came from Poland at the same time as Solidarity.
Yeah, it was a God's gift, Thatcher and Reagan.
Yeah, okay, and then ask yourself, how do we end up with a pope from Argentina at this moment?
Because
the battleground has shifted. Yeah. So, okay. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
That's another program. The Vatican.
Absolutely.
So then the third point, the slow movement toward disintegration. Mainly, really, it's the disempowerment of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union. So in 1989, the Russian Soviet Federal Socialist Republic convenes a newly elected Congress of People's Deputies.
Right.
And the chair, this is 1989, and the chair is Boris Yeltsin.
Right.
Why do we need a Congress of People's Deputies? Well, because he starts building his own independent party.
Right.
And in March 1990, we can say safely that the Communist Party of the Soviet Union was forced or relinquished monopoly of political power, which it had had. The Communist Party of the Soviet Union was the bulwark, what do you call it, the the strength of the Soviet Union. Right. And what happened? Well, its demise began in March 1990 when party elements and party organization were eclipsed in power by state parties, such as this thing called the Congress of Deputies, but also newly created posts like President of the Soviet Union. Gorbachev had become independent. He became the president until he resigned in Christmas 1991. But Gorbachev became independent from the Politburo, faced few constraints for party leaders, except those that rose up in the coup of August 91. And in the summer of 1990, the party convened the 28th Congress, and what happened there? A new Politburo was elected. All the previous incumbents, except Gorbachev and what is his name, Vladimir Ivashko,
right,
the CP, the deputy general secretary, they were all removed. Yeah. And later that year, the party began work on a new program with a working title. It's very significant, towards a humane democratic socialism. Does this remind you of socialism with a human face?
Right.
Because on top of everything else, we are commemorating the 1968 in August.
Counter-revolution, right.
The
counter-revolution in Czechoslovakia, yeah.
Yeah, not commemorating, but we're remembering. Right. And that was... Right. You know, an attempt to create socialism with a human face, with a bunch of literati and intellectuals behind it.
Right, right. A petty bourgeois socialism.
Yeah.
With capital, with a capitalist, with market economy.
Yeah, and they call that a smiley face.
Right. That's it.
Okay. So, right, we're still under key, you know, on the method by which you alluded in the beginning, by which Gorbachev worked his way to the eventual dissolution. So on 7 April 1990, a law was passed allowing a republic to secede if more than two-thirds, this is 7th April, because it's significant to note 7 April, allowing a republic to secede if more than two-thirds of its residents voted for it in a referendum. Now, this was nothing new, because this right to secede was granted by one of the first orders of the Bolshevik government.
That's right.
You have the right to be equal. You can join us. When in 1917, one of the orders was to the former Tsar colonies, let's call them that. The Bolshevik government said, you can join us and be equal, have equal status, or you can secede now or whenever you like. So that was in, and that was repeated in all three constitutions, I think it was, 19-something or other 20s, and then 1936, and then 1970s, and then, I don't know if that was, okay, that clause was repeated in all the constitutions of the Soviet Union that followed the order in 1917. But what happened on 7th April was followed immediately on June 12th of 1990, and the Russian Republic, Soviet Republic, declared Russian sovereignty.
Right.
So what we have here is the emergence of what Stalin was opposed to and fought, white Russian nationalism.
Right. And with Yeltsin at the head. And,
yes.
And Yeltsin, this is June 12th, okay? I was in Moscow.
This is June 12th, yes.
Yeah, 1990. I was in Moscow May 27th or 28th, 1990. Mm-hmm. And I was still there June 1st. And I remember on June 1st, when I woke up, went outside the hotel, I get up early when I'm traveling, especially if I'm, you know, six time zones out of phase. And we're seven time zones out of phase. So 6 o'clock in the morning, I remember listening to Radio Moscow on my shortwave, the English language broadcast from Moscow, but I'm listening to it on my shortwave. And they were discussing, they were reporting on Yeltsin having just arrived in Canada. He was in the Canada and the United States the first week in June, came back to Moscow, and within days they made this declaration of Russian sovereignty
of the right. Russian. Yes.
So you can see where it came from.
Yes, there was. Yeah, this would be a deviation in our discussion, but yeah, Yeltsin was invited by a whole gang of super conservative American, the Heritage Foundation, Dan Quayle met
right.
him, and you know what you're implying. He consulted with the United States.
Yep.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so then you have this declaration of state sovereignty.
Which is a government on the territory of the Soviet Union with a capital in Moscow asserting its own power against the Soviet government. That's in essence what this is.
Yeah. It's just mind-boggling. And, I mean, yeah. So, we're now, these are the points, the background, briefly, of the 1990s. And we come to the year 1991. And we have very strange events. In March 1991, we have the Soviet Union referendum. That's a people's referendum. It is carried out throughout the entire territory of the Soviet Union. Some republics refuse to cooperate, but I think seven? No, maybe, I can't remember. Maybe seven republics participated.
There were the participating republics were let's see the RSFSR the Russian one, Azerbaijan, Belarus, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, Turkmenia, Ukraine, and Uzbekistan. Republics that did not participate: Armenia, Georgia, the three Baltics, and Moldova. In those republics where they did not participate, there was less than 50% voting, but there was still a turnout. And the turnout at 50%, actually, was the turnout here was, they're saying, is about 50%. It was, let's see, Armenia was 72.46% in favor of remaining in the Soviet Union. In Georgia...
See, that was an informal, that the people did it anyway?
What are you saying? The official referendum had been held in Estonia, they wanted to reestablish an Estonian republic. Latvia held one in March of 91, both of them on March 3rd, 91, and also Latvia came. So they organized voluntary referenda without official sanction, and they had lower turnout. But they also, those that voted in those places... voted in favor of remaining in the USSR. In other words, yes, we have our republic. It's an independent republic, but it's still part of the USSR.
Yeah.
Others, there was actually a rather heavy turnout. For example, turnout in Latvia was 436,000, and it was 95% in favor of remaining in the Soviet Union.
So it was carried out through the, as you pointed out, and on Sunday, 17 March 1991, this referendum concerned the preservation of the Soviet Union, and it said the Soviet Union is a federation of equal republics. So it said, the questionnaire said, do you consider necessary the preservation of the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics as a renewed federation of equal sovereign republics in which the rights and freedom of an individual of any nationality will be fully guaranteed.
Right.
That, That was the question.
Right.
So, and as you pointed out, it resulted in a majority of participating citizens voting in favor of preserving the Union as a renewed federation. In fact, the highest approval came from beyond the Urals, from the Asian republics.
Right. You know, by the way, before you get off on that, just for context, the turnout in Estonia was 74%, and in favor of staying in the Soviet Union was 95% of that. In Latvia, it was 65%, 95.84% to stay in the Soviet Union. And Lithuania, it was 86.11% turnout, and it was 99.13% to stay in the Soviet Union. So in these republics that had unofficial referenda, the turnout was still more than we get in a presidential election, and it was massively in favor of staying inside the Soviet Union. And those were the places where the most opposition to Moscow resided.
Yes,
okay,
that's
just
right.
So people understand where the people of the USSR were at when these things that we're describing took place.
That's right. So what we have here is what in the West is called democracy, is actually the people vote for the union, the so-called self-appointed leader, and they're not self-appointed, but you know,
right.
these puppets or whatever they are,
right.
they oppose the will of the people, because this is what happens then. In June 12th, same time as, did I have that right? Same time as the 12th of June.
Correct.
There are presidential elections, and Yeltsin gets 58% of the vote. I don't know why. Do you?
Nope. Well, at the time, it was to be president of the Russian Federated Republic, not president of the nation state. It's like voting for governor at that point.
Oh, yeah. Oh, okay. Right, because it's so, I mean, they're just, it's so complicated. It's like looking at the French Revolution, you know, week by week. But anyway, he's elected. So now we come to the so-called August coup and its aftermath. As I said, a treaty, the Union Treaty, was supposed to be signed on the 20th of August. And on the 19th of August of 1991, a State Committee for the Emergency Situation in the USSR is formed, and the president is Gennady Yanayev, and he's the chair, and there are seven other people. And it seems that here's Yeltsin, the nationalist Russian. Here's Gorbachev mucking about and trying to sign a treaty called the Union that will save, according to the West, the Soviet Union. And here's the real people who are trying to save it.
Right.
You know? So it was according... So if you read this event in the, you know, Western accounts, even just Wikipedia, they call them hardliners, conservatives. These are your Soviet loyalists. They're called conservatives,
right,
as opposed to the great liberal Democrat,
right,
that are these thieves that are coming in now. Anyway, it was an attempt by members of the government of the USSR, not members of the government of the USSR, members of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union and of the KGB.
Right.
So, you know, the intelligence apparatus and the state apparatus to take control of the country from Gorbachev. So what was Gorbachev doing on vacation anyway, if he was supposed to sign a treaty?
Right.
This smells really, really bad. And so the coup leaders are described as hardline members of the Communist Party and were opposed to Gorbachev's reform program and the new Union Treaty. Well, yeah, they were opposed to the new Union Treaty that was going to change the name,
right,
of the whole country, as though, yep, there's nothing in a name.
The telling thing is they were changing the name because they were in the process of changing the essence of the relationship.
Exactly. Yeah. And this Union of Sovereign States was the proposed name of a reorganization of the Union of Socialist Republics, is how they put it. And it was proposed by Gorbachev. And it was in our account in the West, it was an attempt to avert an end of the Soviet Union. This is how confusing they make citizens in the West. The Gorbachev was loyal to the Soviet Union and was going to preserve it. With what? The proposal was never implemented because what happened? Because of the August coup. So that was a nice excuse, too.
Right.
And the dissolution, of course, occurred on the 26th of December.
And you know what happened? So what happened before that? Well, we got about a minute left. We're not going to make it into December.
My goodness.
But we've got on August 24th of 1991. Now, you know, we were talking about August 19th through the 21st. But now, which is today's the 22nd that we're recording this. On August 24th, Gorbachev dissolved the Central Committee of the CPSU. He resigned as the party's general secretary. And then 5 days later, the Supreme Soviet suspended CPSU's activity on Soviet territory.
Mm-hmm.
They made the Communist Party illegal, like in a week. So, which was the goal of the United States, Great Britain, and others, Hitler, you know, almost from the inception of the Soviet Union in 1922, and really from the time that the Bolsheviks took control of the government in then October, now November of 1917. And I guess this is where we'll pick it up next week, because I want to make sure we detail what happened in December in particular very
particularly,
thoroughly.
Particularly, yeah, the Bélage-Abbas. Court, absolutely important. Yeah, we have to continue this.
Okay, Luciana, thank you very much, and we'll speak with you next week.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to Worlds Apart Extra. This is in addition to our regular show in which we focus on the people behind the stories. If asked to name the most oppressive Soviet or Russian leader, Joseph Stalin is likely to be among the first to come up. The Great Terror of the 1930s still haunts this country, with millions executed or sent to the gulags. What is much less known is that barely a year before the purges began, Stalin sought to, well, for the lack of a better word, democratized the Soviet society, and the society pushed back against it. These paradoxes of Soviet power came to light thanks to the work of an American academic from Maryland, whom we found here in Northeast Russia, almost 9,000 kilometers away from the old line state.
So before we start reading this article, what I'd like to do is talk about popular fashions, hairstyles in Russia. So for girls, what is probably a really popular hairstyle?
Samantha Lomb is an assistant professor at the Vyatka State University, who's been teaching here on and off for almost 6 years. In the morning, she's trying to expand her students' English vocabulary by discussing beauty and fashion. In the afternoon, she scours the local archives in search of documents which shed light on a much heavier subject, the early years of the Soviet state. I wouldn't be surprised to find a graduate from the Vyatka State University teaching at the University of Pittsburgh, but I think the opposite is still quite exotic. How did you end up here? Well, I started writing my dissertation on the 1936 Constitution, and when I looked in the archives in Moscow, there was just an overwhelming amount of material. So I needed to focus on a region, and one of the regions I found a lot of material from was Kirov. Funding was a little bit difficult to come by. It's not necessarily the most sexy topic.
You say it's not the most sexy topic, but I think it's a very counterintuitive topic on many levels. How did the idea pop into your
head
in the first place?
That's actually how I came to it. I'm like, Constitution and Stalin seem like two things that shouldn't go together. So I wanted to see what this was about, how serious a project this was, whether it was really just a propaganda exercise as it had been described, or if there was something a little bit more substantive to it.
Mm-hmm. Now, the Stalin era is one of the most extensively researched areas mm-hmm. of the Soviet history, and it's also the one that comes with a lot of accepted conventions. One is that this was a strictly totalitarian state where everything was decided top-bottom, and here you are coming out with a book suggesting that Stalin actually tried to encourage what he saw at least as genuine political participation. Why would he need something like that?
Well, Russia's very, very big, and at the time it had incredibly poor infrastructure and very few members of the Communist Party in rural areas to govern it. So governing the Tsarist Empire, the Soviet Union, and modern Russia has always been difficult simply because of the expanse and the fact that the population is not densely settled.
Now, Russia has a very peculiar relationship between people and power, and it's usually assumed that leadership suppresses the people's demands for rights. But I take it from your book that in the case of the 1936 Constitution, it was actually the other way around, that Stalin was actually more liberal and progressive than society could take it.
Yeah, I was quite surprised, too, when I was looking at particularly habeas corpus, which is the right to the ability to have rights when you stand trial, to not be arrested without the sanction of the procurator, etc. People were not interested in that. That was something that was designed as part of actually Vyshinsky's reforms to get away from this revolutionary legality and sort of the unequal implementation of both punishment and arrests. And people weren't interested. People had a lot of problems with crime in the countryside. And it tended to be crime that the state didn't prioritize. Things like drunken beatings, theft, hooliganism, that posed a real threat. Arson mm-hmm. to people's daily lives was deprioritized. So they wanted the ability to arrest people that destabilized their lives on the spot.
Now, you told me before that people in academia really advised you against using the word democracy mm-hmm. when it comes to Stalinist Russia, because they include this notion of civil society that is central to the idea of democracy. But what you're describing suggests that there wasn't totalitarianism at that point of time either. There was somebody in Moscow with a limited security apparatus, and the rest of the country was essentially lots of self-governance. Is that an accurate impression?
I think that totalitarianism as in general has sort of been debunked within academia simply because more regional studies have proved that they simply didn't have the manpower, the infrastructure to monitor people frequently. You know, I look at collective farms where they have seen district-level officials once every 1 or 2 years. So the rest of the time, they're busy doing whatever they want on their own.
People in the West would see Stalin's efforts to encourage this popular participation as a sham because they would think that genuine democracy would be the impediment to his power. But from what you're saying, it may have been quite the opposite, that he sought it as a means of strengthening his power simply because, again, as you said, he didn't have enough resources and enough manpower to reach to every little corner of Russia.
He actually gives an interview with Roy Howard in which he discusses his views on democracy. He sees it as a whip in the hands of the people to deal with incompetent local officials. He encourages them to be active, to root out those who are not doing a good job. You know, he says, you know, this person is not building a school, if this is dirty, if they are not, you know, providing you the services you need, tell us, vote this person out, because
Moscow simply didn't have the resources to monitor every single, you know, district and region.
So there was this notion of political accountability. Mm-hmm.
Oh, very much so.
Now, I know that Stalin himself was the head of the Constitutional Commission. Mm-hmm. He personally worked on the drafts, making edits. I believe you studied some of those edits.
Yes, he has terrible handwriting.
Have you been able to draw any ideas about his own psychological profile based on things that he, you know, kept in and took out?
Not necessarily his psychological profile, but he tended to be more practical than the other drafters. The original draft was written by Yakovlev, Stetsky, and Tal, and it tends to include a lot of very ideological things. For example, there was a clause in there that parents should teach their children to hate capitalists. Mm-hmm. Stalin removes that because it's not really constitutional material. A lot of the things he pulled out tend to reappear in legislative initiative, things like the number of hours people should work, that sort of thing.
This constitution was adopted barely a year before the Great Terror, which saw millions of people either executed or sent to the gulags. And whenever this subject comes up in Russia, it always centers on Stalin, and much less so on the role that society at large played in allowing that to happen or even facilitating that whole process. Having spent so much time studying the correspondence between ordinary people and their leaders, do you think this progressive constitution offers any insight into the horrors that would follow directly after it?
Well, I know that the 1937 repression is one of the reasons that scholars often cite to delegitimize the Constitution. You know, as you said, how can you be serious about democracy if you then turn around, violate everyone's rights, and kill a bunch of people? My research has shown that certainly there were instances in the provinces of people using their new constitutional rights in ways that were threatening to the local power structure. Mm-hmm. So having these new locuses of power, people were asking to open up churches, people were collecting money to bring back priests. And so a lot of this is genuinely threatening to the locals, and so they certainly would like to get rid of them. And Arch Getty has postulated that you see a lot of pushback from the regional bosses who are threatened by the opening up of the 1936 Constitution, and that leads to repression.
How much is that process of repression driven from the center, and how much was it locally initiated?
Well, the thing is that the repression is sort of multi-pronged. You have, for example, actions against national minorities. That tends to be mostly KVD-driven because they already have catalogs of these people. They've been watching a lot of the national minorities, and those also tend to be related to national security issues, you know, particularly Poles, Koreans. In this area, people from the Baltic states are often monitored. But then you also have the center just simply giving large quotas of the numbers of people that need to be arrested, and they let the locals decide who fulfills that quota. But interestingly enough, by 1939 or 1940, most of them have had their sentence commuted, and they're back in another position of power.
Oh, that's interesting. I heard some Western scholars complain of the haphazard nature of access to the archives. I wonder if you needed any FSB clearance for that. Have you ever gotten suspected of being an American spy?
Well, people joke about it. I've been told that I'm a very nice spy.
Well, most of the spies are usually very nice. They have to get into good graces with people.
It's never been a problem in the archive. Part of it may be my topic. The Stalin Constitution isn't particularly political right now. And my current work focuses on collective farms, which, again, is not sensitive. If I was doing something on the secret police or even the Second World War, it may be a little bit different. But here they've been great with access.
Much of Samantha Lom's research focuses on the correspondence between the locals and the central authorities in Moscow, which was more direct than some would expect. While the newspapers of the time were filled with the praise of Soviet achievements, individual letters often focused on the failures.
We in Russia usually suffer from all the paperwork and the red tape and the bureaucracy, but I assume you're one of the very few people who is actually benefiting from it.
Yes, if the Soviet Union didn't like to document everything, I wouldn't have anything to work with. And everything that they've documented lets me see various aspects of people's lives. For example, this fellow, Kataev Fyodor Fyodorovich. Here in 1934, he's given a prize of 1,000 rubles for his good work. But later in 1936, he's considered a suspect person. So you can see how, you know, the standings change based on their successful implementation of economic plans, different changes in policy, and you can see, you know, these people's rise and fall in fortunes through these documents.
What is it like as a researcher to work with documents like this? I mean, would it be fair to describe them as a treasure trove, or is it something pretty mundane?
Well, I'm always excited by them. It's sometimes people think I'm odd because I'm like, oh my God, look at this beautiful document. And they're like, it's about harvest statistics.
Mm-hmm. Do you think anyone before you worked?
Oh, not on this one, but on this one. This is actually Larry. He's the guy that invited me to Kirov, and he, for his book on education, pulled these same documents. So you can see right here in the front, everybody who's worked on it, and even sometimes which pages they've used.
And it's only the Americans who come here and look at this
boring
stuff.
Well, no, this fellow is Russian from 1979.
Listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Do we know the word infraction? An infraction is some way that you break the rule. Like you can have a speeding infraction if you drive too fast. So it's some sort of violation of a rule.
Having a native English speaker is both a rarity and a curiosity for a provincial Russian university. Samantha's classes also reveal many cultural differences in how the Russians and the Americans approach the world.
You've spent the last 6 years trying to get this glimpse in, of early Soviet life, but I also assume you had to immerse yourself in the current realities of Russia. What are some of the cultural and behavioral patterns that carry over, you know, from that time till now?
You mean things that shock me?
Oh. Not necessarily, well, things that shock you and things that are persistent that may reappear, you know, decades later.
Oh, you mean the way Russia doesn't really have much of respect for laws. It's very interesting because Americans are generally rule followers. If there's a rule, we don't even question it. We simply do it. We stand in line. We pick up our garbage. We just, you know, if there's a rule that says you need to have students do an evaluation, we don't even question it. We just hand out the student evaluation. I remember here for student evaluations, teachers were scandalized. The idea that students who didn't know anything would be evaluating them, it would turn the entire system on its head. And Russians like to get around laws that they find annoying or inconvenient. Part of it is just to think because to do things the correct way is often very difficult, if not impossible. There is, sometimes I'm reminded of the novel Catch-22 when I live in Russia because, you know, you need the spravka to get this piece of paper, but to get the piece of paper,
you need the spravka.
Yep.
Now, one of the characteristics of contemporary Russia is how uneven its development is. You've got some regions like Kaluga, for example, where the local corruption has been brought to a minimum, but at the same time, you have regions in the Caucasus where you cannot do anything without the bribe. And that reminded me of the research you're involved in right now about the differences between the collective farms. And the idea that I got from your research is that what matters in Russia the most is not the ideological framework, but, you know, the actual person in charge. Is that still the case?
In Russia, I think very much so. I think that personal networks are very important. I think, you know, my students looking for jobs now, it's often more important who they know than the qualifications that they have. It's also, you know, if you're friends with somebody, they maybe protect you. They help you get resources that you don't have access to. But, you know, this sort of good old boys network exists in a lot of American small towns, too. And that's what it reminds me of, this good old boys network. And it's because the normal channels of communication often don't work. Certainly in the Soviet Union, the only way to get things done was to ask your friend who, you know, paid someone with some volunkey to get you some seed. You know, you see this most acutely during the war where you have shortages of everything. You have this barter system and the, Rykholm chairman becomes sort of the go-to fixer for everybody.
One more parallel I found interesting was you mentioning that Stalin wanted to have this competent technocrat staffing the state system. And there is a similar desire on the part of the current Putin administration to have the technocrats in charge. But for some reason, neither the Stalin administration nor the Putin administration couldn't find enough of those people. Do you think they, perhaps do they have a problem with the recruitment system, or do they run against this informal system of relationship that you mentioned?
In the Stalinist era, the level of education was a huge problem. You know, you have people that have, you know, I have one guy, he's the head of the district land organization in Zuzinski district. He's a chronic alcoholic with a second grade education. You know, at some level, you cannot expect competence from these people. Most people only had a elementary school education. Some people did have university, but it was very difficult. And so just getting the level of education up so that they could, deal with the volume of paperwork and just regular work that they were expected to do. They also expected an awful lot from these poor men. I feel deep, deep sympathy for my Rykholm chairman, because they were expected to, you know, organize harvests on the collective farm. They were expected to go out and do propaganda work. They were expected to study Leninism and Marxism. And they were expected to, you know, have all of these different meetings. Some of these people had like 84 different meetings a month, you know. They simply couldn't keep up. And I think that modern Russia faces a lot of the same problems, that you have chronic understaffing of a lot of bureaucracy. And even when you get staff, it just seems like it doesn't work particularly efficiently because of this desire to fill out all of this paperwork. You know, with Soviet Union tried to fix things, a lot of the reforms involved more paperwork and more paperwork. And I think, you know, this reliance on fixing things through paperwork reform is a problem that the Putin administration shares.
You said before that even at the height of totalitarianism, Russia was undergoverned. In other words, the central authority didn't have enough manpower, resources, technology. How much is that still an issue today?
I think it's a huge issue, particularly in provincial areas, because you have, you know, I've been to villages where it feels like you've gone back into the 19th century. Some of them don't have electricity. Most of them don't have indoor running water or indoor plumbing. You know, healthcare, transport are all very difficult. You know, if there's a bus, it's, you know, far away out on the road. It only comes occasionally. A lot of the roads are still mud.
Now, polls in Russia consistently show that people's attitudes towards Stalin are changing from overwhelmingly negative to more neutral and even positive. How do you interpret that?
Well, I think Russia took a real blow to its sense of self during the Yeltsin years. It lost a lot of power, a lot of prestige. The economy was terrible. And I think under Putin, Russia has sort of come back into a sense that it's a global player, that its voice matters. The economy has picked up. Russian people are becoming more proud of being Russian. I remember even 6 years ago when I first came here, people kept apologizing to me for how terrible everything was, that this wasn't like America. And I had to finally tell them to stop. I'm like, I knew when I came here that this wasn't going to be like America. You know, and that for me was weird because Americans never apologize for our country. We're like, welcome to America, enjoy. And for people to be ashamed of their country was so different. And now I don't really see that. I see people are more proud of their country. And I think Putin has used Stalin, and particularly the Great Patriotic War and the victory there, as a way to inspire nationalistic pride.
Now, you said before that the Russian people are generally good at gaming or circumventing the system. And I wonder what's been your experience in dealing with the bureaucracy and the red tape, which I'm sure you've encountered here quite extensively.
I find it very frustrating. And it's often very counterintuitive for an American, because we're expecting that it should be easy. People should be helpful. You know, if I have a problem, you shouldn't yell at me. You shouldn't send me to a different department. things are very difficult to fix here. For example, I have two bank cards from Sberbank. One of them is issued to the name of Samantha Lam without the H, and the other one is Samantha Ann Lam. And they cannot merge the two accounts because neither one is how it's written on my passport. Even though I have my passport, I'm clearly the same person. It's issued by the same organization, but they can't fix it. In the U.S., you would.
But since you've stayed here for such a long time, 6 years already, I assume that you perhaps also gotten into the habit of not skirting the rules, but perhaps being a little bit creative with how you apply them.
I am not sure that I've noticed it, but some of my friends have remarked that I have become bulyarusky.
But, you know, the reason why I'm asking these questions is because, obviously, through the American perspective, this country may have major issues with corruption and its legal structure. I wonder what's your gut feeling about how to fix it. Do you think the American system would work in this country,
no,
or would Russians have to come with their own understanding of what the rule of law is, and would that understanding be different from...
I think it would absolutely be different. You have a completely different history with the rule of law. I mean, Russia doesn't really have much in the way of rights, even citizens, or the rule of law up until about 1905, when you get the Tsar making some concessions. Then you have the Dumas, and I think you were moving towards the rule of law. You know, you have the establishment of an independent bar. You have, you know, elected representatives, even though the Tsar increasingly manipulated the franchise to get more and more conservative monarchists in the Duma. But then the Soviet Union blew that out of the water.
Even in your academic work, I think there is a bit more understanding of the complexities of this country than we would normally expect from American scholars, because some of them do come with the degree of what Russia is supposed to do and where it's failing. I wonder how challenging do you find this balance between looking at your own country and at this country with an open mind and, I guess, a degree of compassion?
I don't know that I find it challenging. Where it gets challenging is trying to get other people to listen to and accept your work. There are certain narratives that it's difficult to break out from. My work, you know, the idea that Stalin could have been interested in democracy has hit a wall with a lot of people. You know, see a lot of comments, you know, Stalin was a dictator, the USSR was totalitarian, it was really a ruse, look at the 1937 repression. And even, you know, within academia, there's this, you know, Putin is often a joke, this idea that he's some sort of evil dictator who oppresses his people.
It's not only in academia where she's challenged some conventions. Samantha's habit of walking her cat on a leash raised a few eyebrows, but the locals have quickly gotten used to the quirky American lady.
I certainly get a lot of attention, but most of it's positive. My neighbors think my cats are pretty. I get asked lots of questions about them.
How difficult was it for you to adjust to your life, not just in Russia, but in, you know, in provincial Russia, which has its own challenges?
The first 6 months were really kind of hard, in part because I was alone in the dormitory. Once I got a cat and start making friends, and I had people to meet for tea or to go visit their house.
Пожалуйста, проходите. No.
It was fine. In many ways, it's not that much different from my hometown. I came from a little town where there were more cows than people. And I sort of like the slower pace of life.
The relationship between Russia and the United States got from mediocre to bad to worse, I think, over the last 5 or 6 years. Have you noticed any difference in how people relate to you, how they treat you?
No, not really. I think Russians are pretty good at delineating the actions of a government and the actions of citizens. Every now and then, for example, on Victory Day, when we talk about who won the war, I get some pushback. You know, they ask me, did America say we won the war? Of course we said we won the war. It's our textbook. But then, you know, there's some pushback because, of course, the Soviet losses were far greater and people are very proud of their relatives that served and died. I realize that there is, you know, a great pride in this and that the Soviet Union sacrifice was big, but most Americans probably don't. And so some issues like that, I've noticed some more pushback, but overall, most people know me. Most people are very friendly.
Do you ever find yourself in a position of having to explain, condemn, or defend the actions of the American government? Because I think there is a tendency in Russia to sort of treat or perceive every American as the representative of the United States responsible for the policies of the country.
Well, my students know that I'm not a particularly large Trump fan. So sometimes they will ask me about his policies, I think, just to see my reaction. But for the most part, no. Most people are pretty good about realizing that I'm not responsible for the actions of my government. Mm-hmm.
Do you even follow the American politics these days?
I do, because, you know, my family still lives there. I still have interests in the U.S. Most of it makes me sad, to be perfectly honest.
One endearing thing that I noticed in how you describe this region, Vyatka, in your English language interviews, is that you use a lot of collective pronouns, we and ours. And that sounds very sweet, but I wonder if this place really feel like home to you, or maybe second home.
It does. I've been here 6 years. I'm very fond of Kirov. Mm. The people are wonderful. When we aren't under, 4 feet of snow, the region is very beautiful.
But there's, we talked about it before, there's a lot of red tape. There's also a lot of unnecessary hurdles and hustles, I assume, in your life.
Every day, pretty much not, because I've gotten through a lot of those. They are annoying when they crop up, but they're rare, and I really enjoy my students. My kids are wonderful.
Do you think Russia and the United States can ever get along on a state level rather than personal one?
I hope so, but I think a lot of people have a vested interest in the U.S. having an enemy, and currently Russia is the most viable enemy.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess it perhaps works both ways on both sides of the ocean.
Yeah.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.